Okay, my name is Chris Bell, and today's date is August the 27th, 1982. I'm at the home of Brigadier Adam. And last day, I think we talked about Brigadier Adam's life up to and just past his joining the Canadian Scottish, though we didn't deal with the Scottish. We dealt with his private life. And first off, I guess I should ask, why, sir, did you join the Canadian Scottish in 1927, I think?
I wanted to wear a kilt.
Did you?
That's the reason.
Did you have nice legs, or was it?
Well, I didn't know at the time, but apparently I have. It was in February, and I decided I'd go down to the armory, and I walked past the armory door and two or three times before I could stir up the courage to go through the little sally port in the big door. And when I walked inside, there were two recruiting sergeants. One on the right was the recruiting sergeant for the 5th Regiment, or the artillery, and the one on the left was the sergeant for the Canadian Scottish. And as I walked in, the recruiting sergeant, whose name was Hatcher, for the artillery, he practically put a headlock on me. But I managed to struggle away from him.
And you didn't want any part of the artillery. You had your mind set on Canadian Scottish.
Yes, and I had my mind set on the Canadian Scottish. So I walked over to the recruiting sergeant, whose name was Fivey, Dave Fivey. Mm-hmm. And he took me into the orderly room, and I was duly attested and taken to the quartermaster stores and completely kitted.
Which amounted to what?
Well, I got a service jacket, Glengarry, a web waist belt, a bayonet, a kilt.
With what tartan?
It was Mackenzie at the time.
Which was Seaforth?
The Seaforth, yes. The 1st Battalion wore the Seaforth kilt right up until 1930. And there was a little rivalry between the 1st Battalion and the 2nd when it became organized. And the 2nd was issued with the Hunting Stewart kilt first.
Mm-hmm.
And the 1st Battalion rank and file didn't like that very much. They felt that they should have it first.
They had been given preference, the 2nd Battalion, over the 1st for the...
Well, you see, the 2nd Battalion, they thought, what's the use of issuing Mackenzie kilt to them when we now have the Hunting Stewart?
Mm-hmm. But there wasn't enough Hunting Stewart to go to both.
Not at the time. But in a year or so later. No, the Mackenzie kilt, they were told they had to wear them out.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be worn out.
And when a kilt is being worn for parade, I guess it's rather difficult to wear them out.
It is.
Yeah.
So,
Well, tell me, you went down to join, but what was the impetus behind joining? You were, at this time, I believe you had graduated from Vic College with a teaching certificate?
No, I hadn't.
Were you attending Vic College?
No, I was still at Vic High School.
Mm-hmm. As a student?
As a student.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, I'd always been interested in things military. As you know, the Boys Naval Brigade, I got out when I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had the high school cadets, which satisfied me, I suppose.
Well, at the time, I suppose. You know,
yes, and I could still blow my bugle. And I was sergeant of the band in high school cadets,
mm-hmm.
the sergeant bugler. I just decided I'd like to get into the militia. Consequently, I joined the Scottish.
And what sort of reputation, previous to your joining, did the Scottish hold in Victoria, and how did you feel about them?
Well, I'd seen them on parade two or three times, but they were developing a very good sports program, and I was interested in playing rugby, and that's probably one of the other reasons why I joined. And there were two or three lads at Victoria High School who had joined and were playing rugby. There was Jack Horn, who turned out to be an excellent, top-notch three-quarter. And he played for the Crimson Tide and went to Japan. So...
And what position were you?
I? Drawback, I think. I tried fullback. I didn't last very long because I got a kick in the knee that split the bone. The
kneecap?
No, just below it.
Sort of an Osgood Slater's disease.
Yeah, just like that. And that, my career was over.
Mm-hmm.
That was a sore leg for years.
Here, I'll show you something. I've got the same.
Oh, yeah.
But mine was caused by some degenerative disease.
Oh, no, this was a kick, and the doctor said it had split the bone.
Mm-hmm.
And,
has it healed sufficiently enough, but does it still cause you pain?
No, I have no pain from it at all now. Oh, once in a while I get a little twinge.
Mm-hmm. If the arthritis setting in.
It could be, yeah. But other than that, ended my rugby
career.
Yeah.
Had you been approached before to join up because of your rugby skills? Because from what I've heard, they often recruited good rugby players.
Oh, yes, they certainly did. A lot of them were brought in. Cyril Whiteman was one.
Crabtree was another, who I've talked to, Paige Crabtree.
Ken Crabtree, yes, and Larry Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
I think you met him.
That was Matt, yeah.
And Fred Cable New.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there were a number that came in. Oh, Campbell Forbes, Bill Oliver, and we had a cracking good rugby team.
Do you think that's a good excuse why I managed to enlist or be coerced into enlisting because of his rugby skills?
I don't think any of us were coerced.
No, but persuaded you'll enjoy joining the Canadian Scottish, play rugby for us. It's a great life.
Yeah, but once we got in, we enjoyed what we did on the parade square.
Mm-hmm. So being a team rugby player didn't give you preference in the armory or the mess?
None whatsoever, except that the individuals who were rugby players turned out to be leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And of the numbers who were brought in, the majority who came to play rugby for the Canadian Scottish were commissioned.
Mm-hmm.
There were 7 or 8 or 9
commissioned players.
When I was commissioned, who were commissioned along with me, and they were part of the rugby team.
Mm-hmm.
John Rockingham, Major General Rockingham, was another one.
He joined roughly the same time.
He joined a couple of years later. I think it would be about 30 when John Rockingham joined.
Mm-hmm.
But he joined to play rugby. And turns out to ends up as a major general.
Mm-hmm.
So that, there was some incentive that way, but I never felt that, I wouldn't say we ever felt that we were coerced.
Mm-hmm.
We were probably pressured a little bit, but, or coaxed.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I...
You joined of your own free will.
I did, mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did your parents think of this? Your father had died by
yes.
the time.
Well, when I brought the kit home, my mother was interested right away.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, get that jacket on, let's see how it fits. And of course it didn't. It was
too large or too
small? 10 inches too big around the waist. But she took it and said, they were easily adjusted. They had I don't know what kind of a back you'd call it, but all it had two seams. And it came from the outside of the shoulder and curved in and down the back on either side of the spine.
Mm-hmm.
And all you had to do was undo those two seams and
pull in
and fold it in. You didn't need to cut it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the piece in the center, the plaque in the center, you just brought the two seams closer together.
Mm-hmm.
They were a well designed jacket, doublet, or whatever you want to call it.
Doublet. Who's the commanding officer at this time?
Colonel Don Martin. He took over. He had been acting commander, or acting OC, and he is back. It's the same date as I joined.
Mm-hmm.
21st of January, 1927.
So he took over command at that time?
He became commanding officer, substantive.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to acting. Who did he replace when he became acting commander?
Who did he replace? Well, it was either, I guess it was Sandy Urquhart, mm-hmm. Colonel Urquhart, and the man who was so ill all the time.
Yeah, I think I heard something about that.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a fellow called Wise as well? Was he still with the battalion?
No, Wise had gone before I joined.
Mm-hmm.
He and Martin had failed to, agreed to disagree, because Martin had been made acting commanding officer and Wise was senior to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so Wise packed it up and got out.
Mm-hmm. But that was all in the past by the time you got
there? Yes, that was over before I came in.
Had the mess, officers mess accepted Martin? Was there any ill feeling towards him, perhaps those who were friends of Wise?
Yes, there was, and a lot of the older officers who served with overseas units, they packed it up, they got out.
Because they didn't like what had gone on?
That's right.
But hadn't Martin a very good war record?
Oh, yes, he had an excellent war record. He'd served with the 44th Battalion,
mm-hmm.
and with them he'd received the DSO and the MC.
Could they just not accept him because of the circumstances?
No, I don't think so. I think that it was just the fact that those who had been in the battalion since 1921, when it was reorganized,
mm-hmm.
Felt that he was an interloper.
Mm. Because he had come from outside?
Well, he'd come from Vancouver.
Okay.
He'd been with the, it was either Vancouver or Westminster. It was the 47th Battalion, and they were the Westminster Regiment.
Mm.
And he had served post-war with them. And he came over to the Canadian Scottish as a lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
Lieutenant and brevet major. In other words, it was his substantive rank was lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
and his the brevet was like acting. But then they put him as 2IC over these others.
Mm-hmm. And with the rank of lieutenant?
No, with the rank of acting major or brevet major. And the result was that there was ill feeling amongst these older chaps, and they got out. And Martin, I think, must have had some difficulty in recruiting officers at that time, because when, as you will realize, when he made an intake of, in 1927, the latter part of 1927, of about 9 or 10 subaltern officers, junior officers.
Mm-hmm. These were all young men who had not taken part in the war.
That's right, just like I was. And the ones I mentioned, the football team, the rugby team, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some in. There was Kingham, who had served with the Scottish overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to the RCAF, or RFC. And there was Bob Travis.
Kingham was in the RFC during the war?
I believe so, yes.
Was he a fighter, or...?
Now that I can't tell you.
But he wasn't a pilot then, was he?
I don't know. But I'm pretty sure that he went RFC, he got injured.
Mm-hmm.
And but he came back in to the Scottish, and there was a chap named Christie,
mm-hmm.
Major Christie, he'd served with the Scottish. And Dick Wallace, he'd served with the Scottish.
Mm-hmm.
He was my first company commander. I went into number 4 company. The companies were numerical in those days,
mm-hmm.
1, 2, 3, and 4. And it wasn't until I think about 1930 that they gave them alphabetical names.
So what was the significance of that?
I don't know. I think it was just...
Style?
Style, yeah.
What about Martin's officers? You mentioned the junior officers were mainly young post-World War I officers. What about captains and majors?
Well, I'm mentioning Kingham.
Mm-hmm.
Kingham was a captain, then he went up to major. There was also Jack Gray. He'd served with the Scottish.
Mm-hmm. Was Bob Travis in it at this time?
Bob Travis was in, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Bob came in as a lieutenant. And when I joined, Bob was a captain.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got a company later on. And he had Roy Sargent as his adjutant, that's Brigadier Sargent now.
Mm-hmm.
There was also, some others, some had come from, they had served in World War, before World War I, with the 88th Battalion,
mm-hmm.
the Victoria Fusiliers. And
was Bapti there at the time?
No. Yes, Bapti was there, and Bapti was there as, first of all, as a medical officer.
Mm-hmm.
And we also had Jack Stewart as a medical officer. He'd also served with the Canadian Scottish as an MO
mm-hmm.
in World War I. And there were others. There was a chap by the name of O'Halloran. He was a lawyer in Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a couple of investment brokers, a chap by the name of Branson. He was the pay officer, paymaster.
Mm-hmm.
There was a chap by the name of Henson. Henson, I think, was quartermaster at that time. And they were all the older group.
As a group, how do you think they rated as militia officers at the time that you joined?
Well, that's very difficult for me to judge because I was pretty ignorant of things military in those days.
Mm-hmm.
They were good disciplinarians, and I know that as far as mess etiquette was concerned, they didn't let the junior officers get away with anything. They were, no. And you were very politely taken to one side and told that you don't do this type of thing in an officer's mess.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the Canadian Scottish.
Yeah. They've relaxed the etiquette somewhat, though, haven't they?
Well, it's just the same with all other custom and social graces. They, as far as I'm concerned, they've slipped badly.
Mm-hmm.
One time, and you never spoke to a senior officer except you, sir, or by rank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for instance, if you're in the mess and you wanted to talk to one of the company commanders, you always called him Major so-and-so.
It wouldn't be Bob or
no, the mayor. There was none of this familiarity.
Would a major talk to a lieutenant as Bill or Frank?
No, only by last name. Lieutenant was you only got your last name. You were spoken to as Adam or Mr. Adam.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it was still very formal.
Mm-hmm. How did you react to this this type of life? Because it's something that was alien to you, I take it.
It really wasn't alien to me because I'd had the background, Boys Naval Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
So I accepted it. I took that as a part of military life.
Mm-hmm.
And I never challenged it.
Mm-hmm. Did you like it?
Yes.
You like the discipline
inherent? I think everybody, especially a younger person, once he reaches the age when he can think for himself,
mm-hmm.
he appreciates the structure, and I think it helps him. You know, if you haven't been disciplined,
mm-hmm.
you can't discipline yourself because you don't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm. You need some sort of form of structure.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, military life has to be structured
mm-hmm.
because in battle, you've got to be well enough trained
to
be able to act on your own.
Mm-hmm. But within the framework?
Within the framework of the requirement,
mm-hmm.
military requirement.
Don't you feel, though, that perhaps within that framework, a person, an individual, might become dependent upon the structures in order to function?
No, I don't think so. I think that the training gives you enough flexibility and enough opportunity to use your own judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out that I used to tell my junior officers when I was senior, I said, if you're in a problem, if you reach a problem, and use your own judgment, and if you think you've done wrong, come and tell me.
Mm-hmm.
And if in my judgment, I think that you haven't erred too badly, I'll stick up for you, I'll stand behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the keys in leadership.
To be able to support.
Yeah, to be able to support.
Okay, we're talking about military life.
If someone makes a complete donkey of himself, you can't.
You have to chew him out in order to maintain
that. Oh, certainly, yeah.
Tell me now, when were parades held in late 20s?
In the 27, we paraded on a Monday night and a Thursday night.
For how long each night?
From 8 until 10.
And what would you do at a parade?
Well, various types of things. For instance, when you go in, you've got to take recruit training.
Mm-hmm.
We used to do rifle drill. We used to do squad drill. And once in a while, maybe once a month, we'd have a route march. We'd do and go out if it was still light in the evenings, like in the spring when we'd get out. We'd go to over to North Ward Park,
mm-hmm.
where the Crystal Pool is now. We'd march over there and we'd do company drill, or in the odd time, battalion drill.
Mm-hmm. I guess it was difficult of forming a whole battalion at one time.
Well, yes, and you didn't have really enough. Your companies were not big enough,
mm-hmm.
because you didn't have a full company. In a company, you probably had about 50 men.
That's all.
Whereas on full strength, your company's closer to 200.
Mm-hmm.
So that it was limited what you could do.
Was much emphasis placed on physical fitness?
Well, of course, there's great emphasis put on sport, and
mm-hmm.
that was supposed to develop the physical fitness. But we didn't, I don't recall, except when we went to camp, doing any sort of formalized physical training. Or PT.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we went to camp, we'd probably, right after breakfast or before breakfast, we'd be out doing physical jerks, as we used to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a formalized and a type of physical training.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed today the few officers I saw at the present regiment did look a bit heavy as a opposed to the general public, and I was wondering if in those days some of the senior officers perhaps did not have the physical conditioning of the younger men.
Oh yes, that was true. We had one, I won't mention his name, but he was a what we call a field officer because of major,
mm-hmm.
and he was entitled to wear breeks.
Which were what?
Tartan breeks,
mm-hmm.
like riding breeks.
Oh, I know what you mean, yeah.
And gaiters, or field boots.
Mm-hmm.
He used to wear these these riding breeks and these gaiters, so he was a very heavy chap. I guess he went around about 50 around the waist. So we used to call him Guts and Gaiters.
But this is an accepted fact. And
oh, yes, it was accepted. In World War I, Arthur Curry was a big man. He was, and he had quite a punch on him too when he commanded the Scottish before the war,
mm-hmm.
the Gordon Highlanders. He was known also as Guts and Gaiters.
Affectionately though.
Oh yeah, sure. That's right. Yeah.
But you don't feel this deterred an officer from performing his functioning?
In some cases, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. Before the Scottish went into action, there wasn't one officer there who wasn't just absolutely, just all just flesh and bone. A lot of them, they didn't carry an ounce of fat on them at all.
Do you think it was a good image to project, though? if you're trying to recruit men into a military unit, to see the officers perhaps not in great shape?
Well, we accepted them for the simple reason that they were older men.
Mm-hmm. And seen action.
And they'd seen action. And we just felt that, if they had to go into action again, we'd expect that they'd get themselves down to a weight that would be
acceptable.
Yeah.
And their experience was invaluable, I suppose.
Oh, my, yes, it was. It certainly was. Yeah. We had a very fine regimental sergeant major by the name of Nathaniel Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
He was ex-Imperial Scottish, and he was a very fine person.
Mm-hmm.
You just used them. Well, you sort of idolized them.
Mm-hmm. Sort of looked up to them with reverence.
Very much so.
Yeah. And were they...
Because they earned the respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about the weapons you've trained with. Were they with Lee Enfields or Ross Rifles?
No, we had Ross. We had Lee Enfields.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Enfield with the long bayonet, about a 12-inch, 14-inch bayonet.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a good rifle. We used to do our classifications out at heels.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to do bayonet training. We did all the things that were required. And some of the more difficult exercises, like piling arms.
Mm-hmm.
You won't see that done now, but you seven or eight soldiers got together, and you had a ring or a sling hook, and you were able to set these rifles up in a teepee shape. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you can't do that with FMs?
No, I don't think so. I've never seen it then.
Yeah. They're cumbersome, aren't they, the FM?
The FN is an awkward rifle. I found it so.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an easy rifle to do rifle drill with either. You know, you see, they had to introduce the old style of shouldering arms with the FN because of the magazine
protrudes,
you couldn't slope with it.
That's sort of true with almost any modern arm.
And when you got it at the shoulder, you got a hold of the pistol grip,
mm-hmm.
and it's in an awkward position. Your hand is kinked down like that, and it's a lot. If you have to hold it there very long, it's pretty tiring, and I've seen them lose their grip. They have the hand just automatically opens.
The
muscle, and then of course the rifle falls down.
Doesn't look too smart,
no.
Does it?
Mm-hmm.
What about Lewis guns and Vickers guns? Did you have a full complement of those?
No, all we had was, we had enough Lewis guns for training.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe four or six, and that would be about it.
Were these guns that had been used in the First War?
Yes.
And they were kind of worn?
Oh, yes. They were not new by any means.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the pen, as you called it, was pretty sloppy.
Mm-hmm.
From wear.
Were they water-cooled or air-cooled?
No, the Lewis gun was air-cooled.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know in some of the aircraft they had water-cooled.
Lewis?
Yeah.
I don't think so. You may be right, but
mm-hmm.
I don't see how they could adapt the Lewis gun to water cool. The Vickers were certainly water cooled. Maybe you're thinking of the Vickers mounted on where they fired through the propeller.
Mm-hmm. Possibly, yeah.
Yeah.
They were a big beast, weren't they?
The Vickers?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was heavy.
Did you have any mortars in the Canadian Scottish?
Never saw any.
Yeah.
We had, the only type of thing we had was a rifle grenade, and you could fire a grenade
from the Lee Enfield.
From the Lee Enfield with an adapter on it.
That was sort of a cup-shaped thing.
That's right,
on the front.
Yeah.
I think I've seen some at the...
They're up in the museum. There's some in the museum now.
What about other arms? Anything else?
Well, of course, we had our own... The officers had their claymores.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to do claymore drill or sword drill.
Mm-hmm.
Sword exercises, drawing them and presenting them and so on.
Did you have to buy your own claymore?
Yes. to
buy. Was that an expensive thing to buy?
Yeah, they were. I didn't own one.
You rented one and borrowed
one? No, we had a few spares, or a few in quartermaster stores.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were going out on a parade, you drew one. And the Claymore, the one that you used with your service uniform, you took off the basket hilt and put on a cross hilt.
Mm-hmm.
They were interchangeable. And so you wore a cross hilt on parade.
Mm-hmm.
But in full dress, then you had to put on your basket hilt.
Mm-hmm. Was that just etiquette?
No, it was part of dress regulations.
Mm-hmm.
When you turned out in scarlet for a guard of honor or any other function like that, when you were ordered out in scarlet, then you wore your claymore with a basket hilt.
Mm-hmm. Did you also have to buy your own pistol?
I had to buy everything.
Yeah. Did you buy one for yourself?
No, fortunately I had one given me.
Did you indeed?
Yeah. There was a postman here by the name of, in Victoria, by the name of Hubbs, Charlie Hubbs.
Mm-hmm.
And he had served in the Canadian Machine Gun Corps in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And when I became commissioned, he gave me his Sam Brown and Webley Colt 455 revolver.
Which was standard issue of the British Army, wasn't
it? It was, yeah.
Nice gun.
It was. It was a heavy bloody thing to lug around, though.
Mm-hmm.
And during the war, I had difficulty getting ammunition for it during World War II.
Really?
I managed to get 6 rounds, and that was it, and I carried... I only had 5 rounds in.
With empty chamber on the...
on the first pull.
Mm-hmm.
You pulled on an empty chamber. And that was just so someone, clown, wouldn't pull it out of your... Take some of the... You know, grab your out of your holster and pull the trigger and blow somebody else's brains out.
Mm-hmm.
That was just a precautionary measure.
Did you ever have to use it in action?
Only once. It was just at the close of the war. I was coming down the road from Appledorn down to Otterlo, and a couple of Germans came out of the bush, just out of the trees, and so my driver and I stopped, and I pulled my revolver, and the two of them wanted to surrender, so we just took their weapons from them, put the two of them in the back of the Jeep, and drove them to a prisoner of war cage.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only time I
ever had to draw it. Tell me, when you did draw it, did you shoot off the empty chamber? Did you pull the trigger on the empty chamber, then go to the next?
No. I should have, but I didn't.
Yeah. So that could have been the fraction of a section.
That's right.
Back in the tell me about the camps you attended. And I'm thinking the first one, when you were still a private officer, a private soldier.
Yes. Well, are you thinking of training, of the...
Well, the summer camps.
Oh, well, the first one I think that I attended was in 1928.
So you would have been commissioned by that time?
Yeah. Yes. Because I don't remember going to camp as a junior or as a private or a junior NCO.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about the camp in 1927. I don't know whether we had one or not.
Mm-hmm. Was there trouble getting the money and the time for camps? I'm thinking primarily of the money, because military spending was awfully low at
the
time.
Oh, I know it was.
Yeah.
Well, that's why when we joined, every person who joined the Canadian Scottish had to sign an acquittance roll,
mm-hmm.
and assign his money to the Canadian Scottish Regiment.
And that was everyone?
Everyone, yeah. And the only time you got any pay was when you went to camp.
Mm-hmm.
And if you went to camp, most of them were just sort of Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
So 3 days.
Three days, that's all they could afford.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd be paid then. And of course, the canteen naturally got the majority of.
Well, I was reading something about the 29 and 30 camps. It had to do with going up to Maple Bay and combined operations. Do you remember anything about that?
Oh, yeah, sure. It was either. It would be 1929, I guess. I recall two up at Maple Bay. The first one was we went up, the Navy took us from the Inner Harbor in the minesweepers, the Armenteers, and the either the Gavinci or the Thiepval.
Mm-hmm.
And we went up and landed at Maple Bay and marched in to where our camp was, so about 4 or 5 miles in from the bay itself.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't attacking the shore?
Not that time. In the second year we did.
Mm-hmm.
We were defending, and the Seaforth came over. Navy brought the Seaforth over.
This is the first year?
Either the first or the second, one of the two.
So you defended and the Seaforth attacked you?
We defended, yes.
Mm-hmm.
We defended the Seaforth was the seaborne force.
Yeah.
And along with the, I think one of the others, the BC Regiment.
Mm-hmm.
And the HMS, oh gosh, I can't remember the name of the ship now. I think it was the Sheffield.
A destroyer?
Yeah, British destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
She was up, and they had Marines on board her, and they joined in with the Seaforth to do the assault landing.
Mm-hmm.
And we had scouts out, and we saw the Marines coming up, marching up the Maple Bay Road in column of route. And our commanding officer, Martin, decided to cut them off. So he commandeered a couple of engineer trucks that were in the camp and put a platoon of Scottish in this truck. Then we drove around. I wasn't with them, but they drove around, right around Quamichin Lake, and came in behind them after they got past where these two roads joined, and then took them from the rear.
Mm-hmm.
And the engineers, the Marines, wanted to call foul on this.
You got every one of them?
Put them a whole bunch in the bag.
Oh, that must have really been a blow to their ego.
It was a bit embarrassing to the Marines.
So how did the Canadian Scots do against the Seaforth?
Oh, of course. I think that's still controversial. Yeah.
Were you declared winners?
I can't recall now whether we were or not. I don't remember any kind of a post-battle.
Coming up.
Well, what the Americans used to call a critique.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall any sort of post-mortem or autopsy.
Autopsy is probably the best word. Did you find this sort of thing effective?
Pardon?
Did you find this effective?
This type of training?
Yeah.
No, I don't think it was. It didn't.
We were just playing.
We were just playing the soldiers, that's all.
Having a good time?
I know that they sent me and my platoon up on the side of Mount Sicker.
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't know what I was supposed to do.
Probably guard it.
Well, I don't know what I was supposed to do.
Yeah.
I didn't get any instructions. They said, you just go up there, Mount Sicker. You know, just up there. And the sort of say, might as well say, get lost. Yeah.
What about the following year? Weren't the rules reversed, and didn't the Canadian Scots attack the Seaforth?
Well, in 1930, I was then with the 2nd Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that the 2nd Battalion was still in a defensive role. Now, the 1st might have been doing something else, but I know that the company, Major Bapti, was my company commander in Dog Company, Don Company.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the responsibility of trying to prevent a landing anywhere between 10 Mile Point and out past Mount Douglas to the Gordon Head Cordova Bay area.
That's quite a length of...
Well, sure, and you did it with... you only had about maybe... No, we had a company, and it was a good-sized company. Probably had about 150 men.
With motor transport?
Oh, heck no. Anything that you could get around in. No transport provided.
All probably private cars.
All private cars. And I remember going up and sitting on the top of Mount Douglas to watch for the, see if we could get any signs of the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But they went out and they landed, the Seaforth landed over at the gravel pits over at Albert Head in that area, Squamaw Lagoon and Albert Head. And that's where they did their assault landing there.
And were there Canadian Scots defending that area?
I think the 1st Battalion was. They were with the Seaforth.
Well, that really leads us to an interesting point, the formation of a 2nd Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that done in 1930?
Well, I think Don Martin was the one who was the instigator of the whole thing. And they felt that there were enough potential militiamen on the island to form 2 battalions,
mm-hmm.
or to have two military formations here.
And keeping in mind that the 1st Battalion was only Victoria.
Yeah, it was Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, well, we'll now cover the island with the kilt, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
So they got, first of all, they started A Company of the 2nd Battalion, which was really, it was recruited and was operating as a supernumerary company of the 1st Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And it started up with a subaltern officer, Bob Harvey. He was practicing law in Duncan.
Mm-hmm.
And he managed to get a hold of a couple of other chaps who were interested in militia work. One was a chap named Parker, and the other one was Eric Henderson,
mm-hmm.
who was Larry Henderson's brother. And Eric was a bank accountant for the Bank of Montreal in Duncan, and the three of them organized this Duncan Company.
Mm-hmm.
And they were an offshoot of the 1st Battalion in 1928 or 29.
Mm-hmm. And this gave Martin the impetus to...
That gave Martin the impetus, and then he said, look, this is how easy it is to recruit a company in Duncan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you'll give us a battalion, we'll have a company in Nanaimo, a company in Courtney, a company in Port Alberni,
mm-hmm.
and a company in the hinterland surrounding Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
And this was authorized.
And he had to get authorization from Ottawa to do that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, that had to be done. And it came through in 1930.
Mm-hmm. Which would have been at the beginning of the Depression. Didn't Ottawa, or wouldn't Ottawa have something to say about that? Because it would mean spending more money on their part.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think when it was authorized that they were actually aware of the fact that we were going to have a Depression.
Mm-hmm.
People were still going around with their heads in the clouds.
Much as they are now.
Yeah, similarly, yes. So that I don't think that the economic situation in Canada at that time affected the approval or the authorization of the 2nd Battalion. Well, when that happened, I was the senior subaltern in the 1st Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, well, if Adam will go to the 2nd Battalion, that leaves a vacancy for a captain, and there's a chance for promotion for one other officer. And I took it. They said, look, there's a captaincy vacant for you. Vacant in the 2nd Battalion, would you like to take it?
Mm-hmm.
Which I did.
So what did that mean for you? Because it was outside of Victoria, and you lived in Victoria at the time.
Well, it didn't mean very much. I mean, as far as... It meant that...
It meant a lot of travel, didn't it?
It meant travel, yes. And but generally when I travel with the company commander.
With Baptie.
Yeah, because I went over as 2IC of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And Baptie and I organized, or got it going, got D Company going.
Which was the one that was stationed in the hinterland around.
That's right, yeah. And it sort of surrounded the 1st Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little bit of ill feeling because they didn't like the idea too much of us sitting right on their back door and taking recruits that were potential recruits of the 1st Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
But we had no difficulty at all in raising
the company. Where did you have platoon stationed?
Well, we went to Salt Spring Island.
Well, why there? Did they have a large population to draw on?
A good military background there.
A solid veteran stock.
Solid veteran background and a home of staunch patriots.
Serve a little England over there?
Empire lovers.
Yeah.
And motherland lovers. So we went there and there was a chap in the name of Best, Fred Crofton, who Baptie knew very well.
Mm-hmm.
And Layard, L-A-Y-A-R-D, yes, Layard. And I think some of them had served in the 2nd CMR with Baptie.
Mm-hmm.
But they did the background recruiting. They did the... And in no time we had a full platoon in Salt Spring Island.
Mm-hmm.
And Desmond Crofton came in, and he was took his qualifying course and became a subaltern and took over command of that was 13 platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out into Sydney area. We tried to recruit out there. We had difficulty in getting accommodation. That was one of the problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, where did you have accommodations? Was it an old train station?
There was nothing there. As a matter of fact, we out in Sydney, we had a...